News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. It is a football Saturday here on KMJ. In fact, Fresno State has its first home game of the year tonight against the Fighting Sioux of North Dakota. It'll be the first game on that brand new field turf, Jim Sweeney Field at Bulldog Stadium. And somebody who spent a lot of time in that facility during his life is our guest today. He'll be 87 in a little over a week. Jerry Jury joining me now. He is a veteran of World War II, a veteran of the gridiron in many different capacities, and we're going to touch on that. But Jerry, let's start out early on. You grew up in Ohio, about 30 miles outside of the Horseshoe in Ohio State. And I guess in the 1940s, they had a pretty decent coach there at Ohio State that people knew about. Who was that?
Yeah, it was a fellow by the name of Paul Brown. Well, he was a legend, really, at that time. He had coached in Massillon, Ohio, and had some wonderful ball clubs there. And Ohio State hired him, and he just took over the state.
Well, and as someone who's been involved in the game of football as long as you have, I'm sure you've heard a lot of people refer to Paul Brown, really, as the father of the game of football that we know today. He innovated so much of what we know as football today.
Yeah, I would have to say that he had an awful lot to do with it. He was one of those fellas that grew up and loved the game, wanted to be a quarterback, and I think he really was a third-string quarterback. But he learned the game from the inside out, and really the things that he professed, I think, are still with the game today.
And as you were over there growing up on a farm in Ohio, as so many farm boys tend to do, you probably dreamed of playing for a coach like that. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. I thought that was the only way to go.
So as you're having thoughts like that, you're playing every sport that you can and probably working pretty hard on the farm, I bet, too, right?
I was pretty lucky. I really didn't have to work that hard. I had jobs to do, but some of my friends who lived on farms around there did a lot more work than I did. And I was lucky enough to have parents that I think thought that education and maybe not being a farmer was another way to go.
Well, you can certainly look back and see how that worked out for you. And I want to look back. With all of our veterans, I ask about December 7th, 1941, and I want to get to that. But I guess with your story, I think people would enjoy an anecdote a little earlier on than that. I guess at about the time you were 5 years old, you realized that Jerry Jury wasn't your given name, that there was something else to the story. Tell me about that.
Well, my given name was Townsend Adair. And I had never heard anybody call me Townsend. Jerry had stuck with me, well, since I was born, I guess. And my nurse started calling me Jerry around Christmas time because she thought that my grandfather and I went together like Tom and Jerry, and his nickname was Tom. So Jerry I grew up with. And as a matter of fact, my educational, well, I went through all the schools as Jerry Jury. Mm-hmm. And when I went to Ohio State after graduating, my transcripts were under Jerry, and I had to change them to Townsend Adair. So that was the first big thing. And then when I enlisted in the Navy, my birth certificate was wrong, and I really didn't get to get in the Navy for several months because of that. So by the time my education transcripts and my birth certificate were lined up, I was a little bit late getting into service, which probably was very lucky.
Who knows? Could have saved your life in looking back. I'm curious, just to have a little fun with this, I'm thinking back to my own childhood and having an older brother and an older sister who liked to tease you from time to time. I remember being told once that I was an alien or adopted or, you know, all kinds of crazy stories like that. So I'm curious if when they told you your real name was Townsend, if you didn't believe them since you'd been Jerry your whole life.
Well, I don't remember that. I remember somewhere along the line, I think I was in the fifth grade. Of course, being in a small town, everybody knew everybody. Mm-hmm. And we had a teacher by the name of Bessie Harner, who when she took roll said something about Townsend, and I didn't I didn't answer. I can remember not answering. She said, "What's the matter? Can't you hear well?" I said, "What?" And anyway, I found out that, oh, somebody did call me Townsend. So that, but that, I think that's the last time during school that I was ever called that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly gave you some perspective for your own career in education, a long career. And there might be some of your students or some of the people who played for you or guys who played in games you officiated listening right now. Well, let's fast forward a little bit to your senior year in high school, December 7th, 1941. Do you remember how you found out what had happened way out in the islands?
Not really. That was a Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm.
Being a senior, football was over, and, of course, Christmas time was coming up. We had, it didn't really dawn on me. I heard the president's speech or part of it. I can't remember if I heard the whole thing. But at that time, it was a very dark time, and you thought about it because being a senior, we really didn't know what war was all about. We had heard about World War I and studied it and had met a lot of men who had served in the Army and Navy. But at that time, all of a sudden, there was a big rallying. I mean, after that weekend, it was this, do what you can for the country, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the Navy recruiting came by in January. I kind of remember the first time that we were ever pushed to join up. And I was still, I think I had just turned 17.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the naval aviation man who was a football coach at, I think it was from Mansfield or Massillon. I remember one of the two schools that we were close to. And he had all of the football players in and wanting them to join up. Well, of course, I was excited and I went home. At that time, I didn't live with my parents. I lived with my grandparents in the town of Newark and went to school in Newark. And so I go home that weekend and tell my mother, I said, I'm going to join the Navy. And she says, you're going to what? And she, anyway, I told him that naval aviation was my desire. And she said, well, I'm not going to let you join at 17. They would take recruits at 17 at the time.
If your parents signed for you.
If my parents signed. She says, I'm not going to sign. I said, why not? She said, I'm not going to sign. She said, and if you get somebody to sign, says, I'll swear that you're illegitimate and they won't allow an illegitimate man to become an officer. So I didn't get out. I couldn't do anything until I was 18.
Were you upset about that at the time?
Oh, yes, at the time, because some of my buddies joined up and actually a couple of them went into service before they graduated.
Mm. And that was what was on your mind.
That was what was on my mind. That's right.
And when you thought naval aviation, did you envision flying off a carrier somewhere in the Pacific fighting the Japanese?
I had a lot of visions.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it would be thrilling, and it turned out that it was. But, oh, yeah, I think everybody wanted to do their part, and I felt I might as well have fun while I'm doing it and learn something new.
But since she wouldn't sign for you, you went ahead on to college at The Ohio State University the next fall and probably got to hang around that football team a little bit. Did you play with the freshmen?
Really did. I didn't play, but I did go down on the field quite a lot with my friends. And I was lucky. I joined a fraternity and had wonderful roommates. And so my life was full. But I tried to take in as much of the college as I could.
And then at what point did you decide, you know what, I don't need my mom signing for me anymore, and I'm doing this. I'm enlisting in the Navy.
Well, instead of being drafted, I wanted to do what I wanted to do.
Sure.
So after I was 18, you had to do something, so I signed up for Naval Aviation V-5 program. And my brother-in-law was a Navy recruiter in Columbus, and so he kind of pushed my things along.
He was your brother-in-law already then?
Yes, my sister.
Your sister's husband.
Yeah.
So where did they send you from there? And did you ever think, maybe I didn't make the right decision? Was there ever a point where it seemed a little tougher than you envisioned?
No, never did. I was very, very lucky. I enjoyed practically every day that I was in service. My first place, I went to Worcester College as a V5 program.
And for people who aren't familiar with that, tell me what the V5 program meant.
V5 was a program for, I believe, for young men who were not graduates of college to see if they were educationally sound to become a naval officer. And it was a lot of studying. It was a college program, really,
mm-hmm.
plus the physical training part of it and under the auspices of the Naval. And so you were a Navy cadet at the time.
But it was a way to continue your schooling and kind of accelerate your progress toward becoming an officer.
That's right.
So that you probably were around a lot of like-minded people in that.
Absolutely. That was one channel to become a naval pilot.
And you probably wanted to fly the smaller, faster, more maneuverable planes, I bet.
Well, I think that's the thrill of it. Yes, I would say fighter pilot had to be number one goal.
And by this time, you've seen some of those Corsairs in action at Guadalcanal and some of these Pacific battles?
I don't know if... we saw some of that, but by that time, the F-4 was there, and I think the Corsair was probably going into service at that time.
Yeah, and I guess they would have still been flying Hellcats at that point, too. But well, that's not what you ended up flying, huh?
Well, I ended up with most of my time in PBY. I was kind of in an experimental group that we flew. They wanted somebody or a group that could fly any type of plane. So I was lucky enough to get into that. But when I was transferred to the East Coast, most of my time was spent, I really can't remember. I think there was a squadron called the Black Cat Squadron that was based in the Aleutians, and they had lost about 70% of their men, and they were reforming. They needed applicants, and of course, we were willing to do anything. And so I was asked if I would like to practice some seagoing airplanes, and I said, sure, I would do anything. So I got into the PBY, and it kind of became a kind of a love situation. It was fun to fly, and of course, it was kind of slow, and people would laugh at you, but in the time when on patrol, where there was a lot of things that were very beneficial and fun to do.
Well, I want to hear all about the PBYs, but just so I understand correctly, it sounds like you're saying before you volunteered to fill that role that you got to try your hand in the cockpit of a bunch of different kind of planes?
Yeah, I got checked out in several, but that was when you flew them, it's a little different than checking out. I mean, as for time, most of the time when you're checking out is sitting in the cockpit mm-hmm. and learning about the plane. I had a friend, well, he was a fraternity brother of mine at Ohio State, and I didn't really know him at the time, but he saw my name, and he asked if I would like to kind of get in his unit. And what he was doing was to take the complaints of pilots on active duty about the plane and things that they considered to be dangerous or wrong with the design. And this man asked me if I would like to check out on some. And what he was trying to do is how easy are they to fly? And then to check them for things that they should not do or can't do. So I really got a little experience on that. But as I say, I didn't get much time in any of those planes. But while I wasn't doing that, I was flying the PBY. And so that's how I got all the time there.
Well, and just one more follow-up question on that. I've read a lot about those early days of aviation because people don't realize that America did not have this huge fleet of warships and planes available at that point. A lot of it had to be put into production. And a lot of these planes that people were flying had not really been tested under combat conditions. A lot of pilots were killed in training and learning how these planes flew. So it sounds like you were involved kind of in that area in trying to figure out what these planes would do and what could be fixed so pilots wouldn't lose their lives unnecessarily. Is that fair to say?
Well, I can think of one particular incident, the Helldiver, which was a torpedo bomber, they had complaints that when they dropped a torpedo that there was certain speeds that the plane didn't react well to. And if I remember, it was right around 300 knots if they were in a dive at to pull out that they would get such a vibration that the torpedo would not be released properly, and they were having so many errors. And so this was one that I was involved in the test, and I'll have to admit that there was quite a vibration. And we always had a plane following us. And in the, what we found out that the tail, the Curtiss Wright tail, was not, it was positioned properly, but the air didn't get to the tail assembly where it could maneuver properly. So they put a big trail from the fuselage up to the tail where it used to come in straight down, and they slanted it. And it was because of our, I would say, testing, but experiment as to how to fix that.
To put it into plain English that everybody can understand today, it sounds a lot like you were a bit of a guinea pig there.
Well, I think all of the pilots were guinea pigs. Absolutely. There was no question about that, that it was always a trial and error, and you would try to eliminate all the errors that you could and develop something new that would work, maneuvers and everything else.
And I realized that you were young and gung-ho, and, I mean, you still look great today, so I know you're in great shape and feeling on top of the world, but isn't there some of that, part of that equation that scares you a little bit when you realize you're testing something that isn't working quite right, it's vibrating like crazy, and you don't know if this is going to, a hell diver is going to dive you straight to its namesake there?
Well, I think it was the place that we had the feeling that if something was going to happen, it was going to happen.
So it sounds like by the very nature of your job there as, for lack of a better term, a test pilot, the impact was that you created a situation that was better for the guys who would actually be flying those specific planes in combat, right?
Yes, that's true. And I hope we were successful in doing it, because actually I think that plane did help the war issue quite a lot.
Absolutely. They were very active in the Pacific specifically. And I guess there are probably a few pilots out there that would even go so far as to say the guys like you who did what you did probably saved some of their lives by helping to modify those planes in a way that they'd perform better.
Well, we always look back to the trailblazers who helped us all along, and we learned from everything that every pilot put down in his log, and then you try to improve on that. I mean, it was that's why we went to the moon, and that's one person learns from the people in front of him, whether they made mistakes or did something right.
So you were never scared in any of those test missions?
I'm not going to say I wasn't scared, but I...
Was that one with the vibration, was that the one that you think got to you the most, or was there another situation that took your breath away even
well,
more?
Well, I think that was, you know, that was the situation. The rest of them were just the way the plane handled normally, and little modifications would help out. That's the one where a big modification, I think, had a lot to do with the plane.
Well, I'm sure there are a lot of Helldiver pilots all over the place who are very thankful for that. We need to take our first commercial break, but when we come back, we're going to hear more from soon-to-be 87-year-old Jerry Jury. We're going to tell you where you can see him tonight, where to look for him at Bulldog Stadium. If you've been to a game before, you've probably seen him before, and you might not even realize it. We'll be right back with more Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ. Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and I have three words for you. Ready? Duration, premium, cool. Duration Premium Cool Roofing Shingles from Owens Corning Roofing come with state-of-the-art reflective granules that lower the amount of solar energy entering your home. That means your AC may not have to work so hard, resulting in an energy bill that will go the only direction you ever want it to go, down. I did it. You can, too. Find out more at owenscorning.com or ask for Duration Premium Cool at a Pacific Supply location near you. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the Valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We continue now with Jerry Jury of Fresno, California, originally from the state of Ohio. Spent a little time at Ohio State before he decided to join the Navy. You heard him talk about his days testing different aircraft for the Navy. He alluded to his love for the PBY Catalina, otherwise known as the flying boat. And we're also going to talk about his love for the game of football and how that even led to a very strange wardrobe choice on several Saturdays throughout his life, including tonight at Bulldog Stadium. But before we get to that, let's continue with your Navy days, Jerry. And you talked about the PBY and all the planes that you flew. I'm sure you enjoyed, but there was something special about the PBY. Was it just the chance to land on water or what?
You know, that's hard to really think about. It was amazing that the thing would fly in the first place.
By looking at it?
By looking at it. And then when you taxi it, you're not really a boat. You're just sitting deep in the water. And then by the time you take off, it's just something about it that is really mesmerizing. And then the job that we had to do was much better because I was on the East Coast. And the war was winding down in Germany, so there was not too much action, and our patrols were fairly local, and not much action, so it was kind of a relaxed situation. And I think the relaxed situation is what I enjoyed as much as anything.
When you told us that you volunteered, it was because they had losses in the Aleutians.
Well,
so a lot of our listeners probably assumed you would go there, but what changed to keep you on the East Coast?
No, I don't think that had a lot to do with it. It was the fact that I wanted to learn to fly off of the water and fly all types of airplane. So I didn't think that they would go back to the Aleutians because that part of the war was winding down also. And all of a sudden, I think we kind of thought we found a home on the East Coast. And that's a heck of a lot better being there than it would be out in the Pacific.
Amen to that. What kinds of things did you guys do? Were you looking for subs? Were you just patrolling the coastline? What?
Yeah, we were looking. Well, it was just a patrol. And the patrols would go at different times. I mean, it was so that if there was a sub, and we had some radar, and we had contact with the coast, that if anything was going on, that we were available to help out. That was more of our patrol. It wasn't like the early part of the war where they patrolled the whole ocean.
Mm-hmm.
I even felt it was kind of like a mail run because we would fly to Miami or someplace and land and pick up mail for the Navy and different things, deliver things. So as I say, it was a very relaxed situation.
And where were you based out of?
Jacksonville.
Jacksonville, Florida.
Yeah.
You said at one point, if we saw a sub. Did you ever see a sub? Did you ever have any false alarms?
We had a lot of false alarms. Matter of fact, well, I would say that there was probably a false alarm at least a couple of times a week. You would be asked to check on whatever it was. And a lot of it was different boats and yachts that we would fly over, and and check on to make sure that they were legit.
Any stories like that, any reports that you were called to investigate that ended up making you chuckle a little bit?
No.
Weren't called to investigate any whales or anything like that?
Well, there were sightings, but we never saw anything after that.
And did you ever have occasion to put into use any of the armaments that PBY had?
No. We might drop a smoke bomb on a fisherman or something like that, but
just to mess with them, or what?
Well, sometimes they wanted to know which way the wind was blowing, so we'd let them know.
And I'm sure you never got in trouble for that, right?
Oh, no.
No. So this does sound like pretty rewarding and satisfying work, and I guess you didn't necessarily feel you were in harm's way every day?
Actually, no, I didn't. I never felt that. As I say, I was very lucky. It was a very, if you could call it, relaxed situation to be in. I was very lucky. I was just young enough not to be called out when everybody else was.
Well, and your mom had a hand in that too, I suppose.
She probably did. She had her hand in a lot of things.
Have you ever tried to go back and figure out what might have been different had you been able to enlist when you first wanted to?
Well, I know that a couple of my friends, one in particular, who was 18 and he went in before he graduated, he got to see an awful lot of action, and we would have been in about the same time. So, yeah, I'm glad I didn't have to go through what he went through. Mm-hmm. Would I have done it? Oh, yes. And wouldn't have thought of one thing about it. I would have done it.
I'm sure there are a lot of Navy pilots out there who would say that what you did in testing aircraft and taking troubled aircraft out for test flights to figure out what the problems were takes as much courage as it took for them to fly dogfights in the Pacific.
Well,
I don't think you're ready to say that yourself.
No, I'm not.
But I'm sure they were thankful for the work that you did. In terms of the PBY itself, was there a trick to flying that airplane? Was that a trial and error situation where you made some mistakes early that you made sure not to repeat later?
I would say probably the toughest thing on PBY, of course, we flew the ones they had to land in water. We didn't have wheels.
Mm-hmm.
So when they were beached, then somebody had to get in the water and attach the wheels to the plane. So I think the toughest thing about them was taxiing to get close to the beach without hitting anybody because they couldn't maneuver. I mean, the wind would bother the tail, would turn the tail, the engine would turn it the other way, and we had to put little drags down to guide it. So it was kind of fun, and that was the trickiest part once you learned how to fly. No, it was fun.
That sounds like that would be different every time, depending on the conditions.
Yeah, if there was any wind, and according to what direction it was coming from.
Of course, we've seen the heavy storm activity lately in the Atlantic. Did you ever run up against some weather issues that scared you a little bit?
Yeah, we did, and that was one of our missions from time to time, flying over close to Cuba and the islands that when we would, well, we hit one storm that we didn't know that we were in until we got in it.
That's the worst kind.
And so it was a hurricane that was starting, but, you know, we could get out. Of course, that plane would only fly top speed, maybe if we were lucky to get 130 knots out of it. So 110 knots would be pretty fast, and 90 knots would be normal. You get in the wind of about 120 knots and going downwind while you're all of a sudden a different place than you thought you were. Anyway, I think that was the only time that we ever reported that a hurricane was possible.
That sounds like not the kind of surprise that you want. I mean, it sounds like that would jar you a little bit and throw you off.
We were kind of asking for it. We were looking, and we knew that the wind was coming. We knew that we were in a wind, but we didn't realize that it was as strong as it was. But that's part of flying.
You were flying the plane.
I was flying that plane that time.
And when
that was, matter of fact, that was one of my first pilot's trips, and And I learned a lot from it.
Were any of the crew members on your plane a little disturbed or distressed or telling you to get the heck out of there as fast as you could?
Well, I had a crew chief that had been the crew chief of my pilots, and he had been in the Navy for about 24 years. He was a good pilot. As a matter of fact, the very first time that I had the plane in my command, I let him come down and take my job, and I took his job as the engineer. And he respected that quite a lot. So when we got into the situation, any situation like that, well, I always called on him. I felt that I was always wanted somebody better than me around, and he was my first choice.
So he got you out of this hurricane.
I wasn't in it, but he just said, that's far enough. And when he said far enough, we went home.
All right. Well, I'm glad you did. I'm glad you're here to talk about it. Was it a big deal to you when VJ Day rolled around and the war was over?
Oh, absolutely. That was the thrill of my life.
Tell me about it. How do you remember finding out, and how did you guys celebrate?
Well, they had shut down practically everything on the East Coast at that time, and they wanted pilots that had multi-engine license to go to Hutchinson, Kansas, and fly B-24s. And the Navy had a B-24 that had a single tail they called a privateer.
Right.
So they, after the East Coast shut down, they were considering invading Japan. And when we got to Hutchinson, our training missions were all generally low-level missions where we would fly 150 feet off of the ground. And, of course, Kansas being a nice flat area was always kind of fun to fly a four-engine plane 150 feet off the ground when you'd have to pull up to make a turn. Anyway, we were doing several flights like that. And when the first bomb was dropped, our training kind of stopped. Of course, we were thrilled that the bomb had dropped. But nothing happened that first week, if I remember. I think it was 7 days later, the second bomb dropped. Mm-hmm. Well, that was the one that really we knew that was going to end the war. Actually, our training kind of came to a standstill. Of course, then when they finally said that they were retiring from the situation, what were we going to do but celebrate? And Navy in Kansas was very, well, not too many people knew that there was a Navy, I think,
when
we
were in Kansas.
Anyway, we were all heroes at the time. And I remember Wichita was just a town that came unglued. So anyway, we had quite a celebration, and they called for a celebration. And I remember I was on the plane that went below the level of the buildings in Wichita through on that day. And when we got back, yeah, we were in a little bit of trouble for a while, but
so
nobody.
You weren't told to do that. You did that on your own.
Well, we figured that, guys, we were flying 150 feet. We might as well go up to 500 over the city.
So you scared a few people along the way.
I think they felt they were threatened for a little bit.
Was it worth it?
A lot of fun.
And when you said that was the thrill of your life to learn that the war was over, you say that because there's a good chance it saved your life because of what you would have been doing on those low-level missions in over mainland Japan on an invasion force, right?
Yeah, I learned about latter part of November, December, that one of the reasons that we were in Kansas was to learn to fly long periods of time at low level, which was to stay under the radar from Japan, which would have meant that we would have been flying 500, 600, 800 miles under 500 feet for hours at a time. And then we were to strafe the beaches and low-level bombing on the Japanese coast, which we figured and talked about it that more than 50% of the planes would not come back.
Yeah, because it's one thing to go under the radar, but if you're going that many miles, somebody's going to see you along the way. And when you start strafing the beaches, they're definitely going to know you're there.
Yeah, they know. They would know we were there. We would let them know anyway.
So I bet there's part of you that would have enjoyed the rush of trying that, but the rest of you says you're glad you didn't have to do it. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yes. Yeah, when Truman dropped the bomb, he was my hero.
And still is, I'm sure. Well, we need to take another commercial break, but when we come back, we're going to find out how Hutchinson, Kansas actually was the start of a road that led Jerry to Fresno, and talk about some of the things he's done since then. I keep teasing you about this football game. I'll answer that question for you when we come back. The Bulldogs play North Dakota tonight at 7, and we'll be with you till 2 o'clock here. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ. Rising energy bills got you down? Paul Leffler here telling you to look up. As in, look up to the top of your house and put your roof to work for your wallet. I want to tell you about Duration Premium Cool, the Energy Star rated roofing shingles from Owens Corning Roofing and Asphalt. I don't have to tell you how hot California summers can get, but did you know that installing a cool roof can help fend off that heat? You can take your pick from four distinctive colors. We have sage on top of the Leffler home, but what makes Duration Premium Cool shingles so special is the reflective granule technology that basically bounces sunlight back up to the sky so it doesn't get absorbed into your home. Duration Premium Cool shingles are proven to reflect up to 25% of that solar energy targeting your house on a hot summer day. So you may not have to use your AC as much, potentially giving your air conditioner a rest. So don't just get any roof, get an energy-efficient cool roof from Owens Corning. Find out more at owenscorning.com or ask for Duration Premium Cool shingles at a Pacific Supply location near you.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We continue now with Jerry Jury, soon to be 87 years old. For many, many years, he's called the Central Valley his home. Spent 42 years in education as a teacher, coach, athletic director. Maybe you've seen him on the football field, not just as a coach, but as a referee as well. And you'll see him tonight at Bulldog Stadium wearing a pink hat. We'll talk about that. But let's go back to right after World War II ended. And you're there in Hutchinson, Kansas, as you said, flying those B-24 privateers for the Navy. And I guess once the Navy didn't need you anymore, you decided to play some more football? Or how did that all work out?
Well, there was probably nothing that we had to do on the base at that time. And our commanding officer was a physical fitness and a football nut, and he had a pretty good man on station that was working with physical training at the time by the name of Kenny Gleason, and he had asked Kenny to get a football team together. Of course, he sent out some flyers around for all the Navy personnel to sign up, and he looked and he knew that a lot of the Navy pilots had gone through St. Mary's and different places, and Kenny had played football at St. Mary's with Frankie Albert and that group in 42, which was a great football team. He saw that some of us had gone through St. Mary's, and actually I was on the football cadet team at St. Mary's at the time, and he recognized some of the names, and he called on us if we wanted to play. And, well, sure, we wanted to do something, so he started the football team. And we had a very successful team. We were undefeated that year. And at one time, I think we were ranked fourth in the nation. The only service team that was ranked ahead of us was, I think it was the 4th Air Force that out of Georgia. I think they were third, and we were ranked fourth.
So. And people in today's world, where we have nonstop college football on ESPN, I don't think they understand what the landscape was like back then. But you guys as a service team would play anybody who would play you, right?
That's right, yeah.
I mean, some of the best college teams in the country would play service teams.
Well, and most of the colleges wouldn't want to play us because, here, you know, they had a bunch of young kids in college at that time, and service people hadn't gone back to college yet. That was in 1945. So you would have a bunch of 24-year-old, 28-year-olds or playing against 17 and 18-year-old in college, so they really didn't want to play.
Exactly. Well, and this is how you ended up in Fresno. For people who know a little bit about Fresno State football history, they might know about the great 1942 team, which became nationally ranked, the first Fresno State team in history to do that, a team with a terrific backfield, names like Jack Kelly and Jackie Fellows, Mickey Mussini, some of the names on that 42 team. But then the war happens. So in 1946, they're bringing back football. And Jimmy Rabbit Bradshaw, the coach at the time, I guess somehow made a connection with Kenny Gleason in Kansas?
Yeah, Kenny played for Jimmy at Fresno State.
Mm-hmm.
Kenny told Bradshaw that he had some players that were worth looking into. And so we got scholarships were offered to several of us, and I think there were six or seven of us that came from that team to Fresno.
Had you ever been to or heard of Fresno before?
Yes, I had. Gene Lemoore, who played at Fresno and also played at Great Lakes with Paul Brown, was in my football unit at St. Mary's Preflight. I remember Gene used to come home every weekend. He would sneak out and thumb his way to Fresno because he was dating Jimmy Bradshaw's daughter at the time. So I actually had heard of Jimmy Bradshaw at that time, and he married her. And so I had heard of Fresno, but I just knew it was a hot place.
Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't disappoint you.
No.
And I know we're running short on time here, but I want to get some of these football stories in. So 46 was a big year across the country for college football, and in Fresno specifically. But some of the best players were guys who had spent the last couple of years of their life in a war. And it had to change them. It couldn't help but change them. What did you see in that team? And how do you think those experiences for so many of those players to have been in the military, what do you think the impact was of that on the way the team performed?
Well, we were older. At that time, I think I was just turning 21.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the other fellows like Jackie Fellows and Mickey and Jack Kelly were 2 and 3 years older than me, so they were 24 and 25. And I remember we had a 26, 27-year-old lineman, and it was a mixture that none of us were in the condition that we were when we were in college. So here we had quality players that probably couldn't play a whole game without really not being anyways near as good in the second half as they would in the first. So there was a lot of substitution going on. And in those days, you almost had to play offense and defense. So you played a lot of football at the time. And then you would come out of the game. So you never really got your game established that they do now, where you have a complete offense on the field, a complete defense, and you could rest and be. Anyway, it was 24-year-old experienced kid, men playing with 17-year-old kids, which those young kids learned a lot.
I can imagine. Absolutely. Is there, and you played for the team also in 47 when Kenny Gleason became
Yes.
your head coach for a couple of years. Was there any one game or moment of your time as a Bulldog playing in the backfield on offense and on defense? Was there anything that stands out as a great memory for you?
Well, I do have. Yeah, there was one. You know, we played COP at the time, and they had some good ball players on their team.
And that's what we know today as UOP, the University of Pacific, was then the College of Pacific in Stockton.
Right. Mm-hmm. And we played them here in Fresno in the fog. And when I think the score was tied, and my friend Bill Robinson was in the backfield. We were on defense, and the ball was thrown into the end zone. And I couldn't have been more than 20 or 30 feet away from him. And to this day, I'm not sure whether he caught the ball or not. And he has never answered. Anyway, we won the game. So, as
13-12 was the final score. So this was a crucial touchdown, which may or may not have happened.
Yeah.
The referees couldn't tell if it was caught or not.
Nobody knew. But, of course, I asked him. Yeah, he had the ball in his hand, so we ran out with the ball. Yeah, we won the game.
Well, that's great. And stories like that can only happen with our Thule fog here in the Valley. I'm sure as a referee you ran into some foggy games
yeah.
over the years as well. Really quick, another game that I know I've heard about from that 1946 season, which really, I think, precipitated a lot of things in college football, particularly on the West Coast. Your team was supposed to go play Oklahoma City, and you had African-American players on your team, some of the best players, including Jack Kelly, who had been in the war and come back. And Oklahoma City said they wouldn't play a team with black players. That's how it unfolded, right?
Yeah, we took off from Fresno, and everything was okay. We flew at that time. I think we were to fly directly to Oklahoma City or Oklahoma, but on the way, we had some engine trouble, and we went to Albuquerque. Well, while we were in the air, the Fresno State student body said that because they didn't want the Millard Mitchell and Jack to play in the game, requested that we come home. Well, we wound up in Albuquerque and no hotel rooms, and we stayed in the airport all night long, sleeping on benches and on the floor. Finally, about 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, the plane was fixed. We got on the plane and flew to Oklahoma. We got there. I think the game was at 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I think we got in around noon. And they wouldn't let Millard and Jack in the hotel, so we snuck them in the side door and got them into one of the rooms. Anyway, we went to the ball game we probably had 15 minutes warm-up, and we went out on the field. And I remember Bradshaw was telling us that they had these big old tackles, 290 pounds, 300 pounds. And I remember the names, Marion Shirley and John Nowitzki. Well, anyway, on the kickoff, one of those fellas did the kicking, I think. And the ball came in to the end zone. And I remembered seeing that ball. And they said, these guys couldn't run. They were just big old guys that just rolled around. I remember getting out to about the 5 or 10 yard line. And the first two guys that met us were those two guys. They had beaten the other guys down the field. They could really move. Anyway, Jack and Millard couldn't play in that game. And we had no sleep. I think at the end of the first half, we were ahead 7-0. Went in and sat down, and with no sleep, no benches, we began to cramp up. And I think the score wound up 46-7 or 41-7.
46-7.
46-7. And we were ahead 7-0 at halftime. Anyway, we really felt bad that those two guys couldn't play. But we kind of went against what the university had wanted us to do to come home. And in a way, I'm kind of sorry we didn't. But that's the way it turned out.
Well, and I guess sometimes it takes something as ugly as that to make people aware of how ugly it is. You know, and when they saw that happened, maybe that helped pave the way for things that came down the road.
I had never experienced anything like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think our kids on that team would have almost forced those guys into the ball game. Mm-hmm. And then we would have had, well, we don't know what would have happened at that point.
Probably a pretty big brawl.
Yeah, that would have been too bad. That's the only time that I was ever a part of anything like that. It wasn't a good feeling. But from that time, it sure made us close. We were a close-knit group from that point on.
Well, and I know I could sit here and talk to you for hours about some of the stories of those old teams and some of the terrific athletes that a lot of people don't know about today. If we had the 24/7 news cycle like we do today, some of these names would be a little more popular than they are. But I want to take the last couple minutes we have to talk about what you did from there, because you got into teaching and coaching, you got married, you had 3 kids, you got 7 grandkids, and you still are part of football. Tell everybody where they can see you tonight at Bulldog Stadium and how they'll know it's you by what you're wearing.
Well, I'll probably have a pink baseball cap on.
Because that's your favorite color.
Well, it's not my favorite color, but it's become kind of a tradition among my friends. And people recognize the fact that what's going on when they see that pink hat. It's supposed to be a red hat.
Mm-hmm.
The position is called red hat.
That's right.
And it is a liaison between the officials and the TV. And that's my position, is to keep the game going, keep it running smooth, not to let it become a TV overproduction, I'll put it that way, because TV is important. And also to keep the players from getting too cold and keep the game moving.
And so when they see a timeout and they see a guy with a red hat, or in your case, a pink hat, on the field preventing play from continuing, that's when they'll know that you're doing your job, because you have to get that television timeout in. And it was never your ambition to become the pink hat on the field, but you came through this by coaching as an athletic director. You had coaches like Bob Bennett at Bullard High. You coached basketball yourself instead of hiring Jerry Tarkanian for the job, which I know there's a story there. But you were an official for a long time, refereeing football games. And I guess you got a pretty long line of guys that worked with you who have gotten to some pretty high heights in football officiating.
Yeah, I was lucky. We had a couple of supervisors that really knew officiating, and he created quite a group of young men to officiate the game. I was lucky enough to be involved with him. Well, you were referring to Mike Pereira, I believe, and Tony Carreni, and some of the fellows who I was lucky enough to be involved in their first ball games in Division I. Well, anyway, when I retired, I was given a surprise retirement party in Stockton, and there were fellows from all over the country that came. And anyway, at the end of it, they wanted me to stay in football, and they said, "Will you stay in if we can find a job for you?" I said, "Well, yes." So Mike pulls out this pink hat. He says, "If you're man enough to wear this, the WAC has said that they'll let you go on the field and be the red hat if you wear the pink hat." He said, "Will you do it?" I said, "I certainly will." He said, "Well, you got the job." That was in 1991. I guess it was 92, because I retired. I worked my last season in 91.
And so 2 decades later, that pink hat lives on. You think there are any other pink hats around the country?
Oh, no. That's the only one.
One of a kind. And now we know the story behind that pink hat, now why it's pink and not red. Well, Jerry, we're out of time on the program, but is there anything else that you'd like to share? When you look back over everything, you look at how your life's worked out, your service during World War II, the fact that your mom intervened, wouldn't let you go when you wanted to, the fact that the bomb was dropped when it did, you know, the fact that the war ended when it did, you were able to make it to Fresno, play football, meet your wife, Gloria, have a family, have this career in education and in football, and you're still involved in that. What are you most thankful for, and where do you give the credit for all of that?
Well, I guess I was pretty lucky. I had some good genes, so I've remained healthy. I was never really seriously hurt in football. I did break a leg, but I walked off the field with it. I think my health and the friends that I've made along the way have really made my life a lot of fun. If I can't have fun, I don't want to be around.
When are you going to hit your fifth hole in one?
Well, let's see. I'll be playing next Wednesday.
I like that spirit. And finally, I guess the only other question to ask, because I've told people to look for you at the game tonight, find the guy on the pink hat that's keeping the game in a timeout. How long are you going to keep doing that?
This is my last year.
You're announcing your retirement on this program?
Well, I guess so. I think it's time. I played my first high school game in 1939, and I think it's time to get out.
If they gave you a red hat, would it keep you around another year?
Will it fade?
Ask Pat Hill. Well, Jerry, thanks so much for serving our country, for your long service to the sport of football and education here in the Central Valley, and thanks for telling us a few of those stories.
Thank you.
Jerry Jury has been our guest today. Wish him a happy birthday in a little over a week when he turns 87 on September 25th. And tune in again next week for another edition of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.